If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Wanted to let you know that the Sound Stream is now available exclusively on the Sound app. You can now listen 24/7 to a music stream featuring jam bands and more, much more. So not just what you'd expect, but a few surprises along the way too. Curated by the Sound Media Team, the stream offers up your favorite songs by your favorite bands and artists, both live and in the studio. We'll also be adding specialty programming and much more. So get it today and listen wherever you want for free. Get the app for iOS and Android by searching for The Sound Podcast and Stream or at app.thesoundmedia.com. Just hit the orange button, press play, and boogie on. The show starts now.
Talking up.
You've been listening to Jono Manson featuring Joan Osborne and Loved Me Into Loving Again from Jono's forthcoming record, Silver Moon, due out April 10th. Silver Moon actually marks the 10th solo record for Jono Manson, and while you may not know exactly who he is, you absolutely should. In fact, Jono should be credited with helping restart the neo-jam band scene in New York in the 90s. That is to say, his band The Worms, an eclectic dive bar band playing out of Nightingales in New York, paved the way for bands like Blues Traveler, The Spin Doctors, and Joan Osborne. More to the point, they were all big fans of his work and continue to lend a hand today. So when we got the absolute privilege to talk with Jono, that's where our conversation started, when I asked if he thought his eclectic sonic potpourri of sound was indeed responsible for the neo-jam band movement of the early 90s and the days since.
You know, I think at the time, and I would imagine that to a large extent, anybody who's kind of in the middle of a burgeoning scene, you know, when you're in the center of it, you can't really see it as such. You're just doing what comes naturally to you, you know? So the short answer would be no. But, you know, that time, the late 1970s in New York, which is when I really started playing in clubs and venues and bars and wherever they'd let us, you know, was a really vital time. There was an explosion of live music of all kinds, you know, sort of as a pushback to the end of the disco era and the whole advent of punk and new wave and all that stuff was sort of, I think, really is what, if you want to really go back to how that music scene began to what was first spawned, it was all of that kind of set the stage for an acceptance of all kinds of music. You know, people, the audiences we played for didn't get thrown off by the fact that we would go from funk to rockabilly to surf to every kind of music mixed together. And, you know, the kind of shows we did weren't jam band shows necessarily in the sense that people think of them today. We did do extended jams of songs, and we would go from one song into the other sometimes without breaking in between and sort of morph from one thing into the next. But it was a little bit more, rooted in sort of roots rock and sort of roots of American rock, but no, I mean, it was difficult to say, you know, you don't really think about it in those terms, that we're spawning some kind of new movement or influencing people in a way that in hindsight, I guess we did.
Yeah. I didn't mean it to say that specifically it was the way jam bands jam out songs or any sure. of that. What I was speaking to more was, the eclectic nature of the songs. You were an iPod on shuffle before iPod on shuffle even existed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, I was only making that distinction, not out of any kind of, you know, whatever. I was just making the distinction right. about the kind of shows we did just because it was different. But I do see, like, sort of, it, you know, in terms of the way the shows went and the fact that they were long and we did jam, that it was definitely the beginning of that scene, at least that sort of neo jam band scene in New York at the time.
Right. And so, you know, you've been at this for quite a long time, and I don't mean to date you, because I think the experience is far more important than the length of time. That's sort of irrelevant because you're still at it now. But you know, those shows in the 80s and early 90s, brought you to Nightingale, where you did help form the scene for people like Blues Traveler and Spin Doctors and Joan Osborne. And, sure. You know, those are just the ones off the top of the head, but
yeah, there were lots and lots of other bands that were part of the scene that are some of them still active who didn't become, you know, household names like the ones you mentioned. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, did you know when you saw John Popper and his immense talent, or Chris Barron and his ability to be a front man, or Joan's voice for the first time, did you know that these three rock icons of the day were the shit, were going to make a career for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, well, for example, Blues Traveler, John is a year older than the original, you know, four-piece band from back in the day. Yeah. John is 1 year older than the other three guys, than Bobby Chan and Brendan were. And so they, you know, and they, there's a sort of a fairy tale story. They were a high school garage band that never, by the time they got a record deal, none of them had ever played in any band but Blues Traveler, you know? John, because he was a year older, graduated from high school before the other guys. And so he used to come, they were from Princeton, New Jersey. So John used to come across into New York and was poking around in the bar. So I remember meeting John before hearing Blues Traveler, and John would come and sit in, and yeah, of course, you know, he was already a monster player. And then when Blues Traveler came and started playing, you know, some of their very first gigs were there at the Nightingale, which, for some of the listeners who don't know, was a dive bar on the corner of 13th Street and 2nd Avenue. And it was a small bar that didn't even have a stage, you know. But as I said earlier, so many at that time in history, every place that was able to fit a band in the club started having live music. You know, there was sort of an explosion. And this is one place that for many reasons, some of them explicable, some, you know, we'll never know why exactly, became a scene, you know. And then so, yeah, Blues Traveler, some of their first gigs were opening for my band at Nightingale. And the first time I ever set eyes on Chris Barron was before the Spin Doctors really formed. They might have had a sort of a nascent sort of version of the band that hadn't yet really started gigging, because those guys all met at the New School for Social Research in New York in the jazz program there. First time I ever laid eyes on Chris, he would do like a little solo set in between Blues Traveler's sets at the Nightingale. You know, just like him and his guitar, singing his songs, some of which went on to become mega hits. You know, he wrote Two Princes when he was 19, you know, and Joan, I remember the night, I can remember it clearer than I can remember a lot of things that happened yesterday, but that's another story. I remember the night getting off the bandstand at the Nightingale that Joan walked up to myself and Jerry Duggar, who was the bass player in the Worms at the time. And the first words I ever heard Joan say to me were, "Hi, my name is Joan and I want to be a singer." You know, it was before she'd ever performed in front of people. Jerry actually, I think, helped put together the first rhythm section that backed her up. And in those days, she was just doing blues covers and standards because she hadn't started writing songs yet. And then also during that period, I would sometimes be a member of her band. So these are all people. And, you know, the first time I met her, I hadn't heard her sing yet. But once I did, you know, it was clear that she had a great deal of raw talent. She's someone who, over the years, I think she's a singer who, as she's, you know, gotten older, her voice, to me at least, just gets better. You know, there's a lot of singers that, you know, when their voice becomes more aged, you know, maybe people's, I can't speak for Joan's range because she sings beautifully, but, you know, sometimes maybe your range isn't as wide as it used to be, but the quality of your voice and the experience you carry with each note you sing is increased with each passing year. And I think she counts as one of those people.
So there's hope for me still.
Absolutely, Ira. Absolutely. You know, and I have a nice studio here in Santa Fe. So when you're ready to really, you know, step out and put out that groundbreaking album, come and see me.
Yeah, well, we'll be waiting. We'll be waiting a long time, I think. You know, what's interesting about all three of those artists is that they had tremendous commercial success fairly early on. Mm-hmm. And it's that commercial success that may have, to a certain degree, ruined them. Not, I don't want to say, yeah, it may have ruined their commercial viability. Let's say it like that. You know, you can think of Two Princes, or you can think of Run Around, or If God Was One of Us. And that's how the average individual knows these people, not fans of these people, but the average individual thinks of these people. And so they had immense success. And with that immense success, they got away. And while they didn't get away from what they wanted to do, it sort of was like the success didn't follow them after that. It's kind of sad, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, well, like, for example, Blues Traveler, they you know, worked and worked and worked. You know, they got signed by Bill Graham, became their manager, and, you know, was instrumental in getting them their first record deal. David Graham, who's also a friend, you know, Bill's son, went to Columbia, and they played at some, like, sort of frat event at up at Columbia University in, you know, Upper Manhattan. And David Graham saw them and started following them, and called his dad and said, you've got to check out this band. And this is obviously a simplified version of the story. And anyway, mm-hmm. Bill Graham signed them and put some resources behind them, you know, and helped them get their first record deal with A&M. And, you know, it wasn't until their fourth album that they really achieved, you know, big time, that the Blues Traveler 4, their fourth album, had Run Around and Hook, their biggest hits, and The Mountains Win Again, and other songs that they're most known for. But by the time Blues Traveler 4 came out, they had been, you know, touring nonstop, developed a rabid grassroots following. But you're right, the average radio listener in middle America knew them from their radio hits. And as a matter of fact, I toured with them during the time that their fourth album was blowing up. And, you know, there would be the crowds at their concerts changed. It was all of a sudden, you know, lots of like 13-year-old girls who knew that one song in the audience and like were just waiting to hear the radio hit, you know? Yeah. You know, and the same thing to a greater extent, the Spin Doctors, you know, they had a live album that came out before Pocket Full of Kryptonite, which was way, in terms of commercial success, way bigger than Blues Traveler 4. And that was their first studio album. Yeah, and it's hard to follow that up. It's hard to, you know, on the other hand, I don't think any of those guys are complaining, you know, about the commercial success they've had, because they're all still working. They're all still playing. They're all still making records. They're all still collaborating with different people. I mean, I still work with I still write songs with Chris Barron. I produced John Popper's last solo album.
You sure did.
I just came from New York 3 days ago, where I just filmed a music video with Joan Osborne, who sings a duet with me on my new album, which will be out in April. And actually, the single that Joan and I recorded will be released in just about 2 weeks.
It's good. And I understand that they are still active. I just, you know, I saw Blues Traveler again, probably for the 20th time just a few months ago, and sure, it's true, people even still today are hanging out waiting for Run Around or Mountains Win Again or Hook, but they're not, you know, cheering for All in the Groove or sure, some of the songs that, you know, but anyway, you know, some of the songs, All in the Groove, in my opinion, is one of the best songs John has ever written, and it doesn't, you know, people don't know it because people don't know their best record is Travelers and Thieves. People don't know that. Like, and it's, look, to me, that's weird. It's really weird.
Yeah. But I think I understand what you're saying. And I think that the same can be said for a lot of bands that, you know, I mean, the Allman Brothers, the average, you know, the average listener knows, you know, Ramblin' Man, you know, and Sweet Melissa, and, you know, some of the big radio hits, you know, maybe Whipping Post or, you know, what have you. But this, you know, there's such a deep, deep well of music that, you know, that, and, you know, I think, like I said, I think that it is weird. Like, I agree with you. But on the other hand, I think if you were to ask Chris Barron or John Popper or Joan Osborne, whether they regret having had those hits, I would be very surprised if any of them said yes, you know, because and also you have to recognize that all those bands rose to popularity at the very end of the era in which such a thing was possible, you know, in terms of gigantic commercial success of the kind that translates into economic remuneration, you know, because shortly thereafter, by the end of the 90s, the music industry was changing drastically in ways which we all know about. And so, you know, I think that also to their credit, like, for example, Joan, you know, she's maintained her audience. She can sell, any like mid-sized theater in the country. She's doing projects that she enjoys doing. She did an album of Bob Dylan songs because that's what she felt like doing. And she's just about finished doing her next album of all, you know, new tunes and stuff like that. And, right. You know, they're all still very active in a way. So I don't think, you know, I agree with you that phenomenon is weird, but I don't think any of this, you know, killed anybody's career, you know?
Right. It was just, you know, the rise was meteoric and then it sort of came down to it plateaued. It plateaued.
There's a big risk. Like, for example, I've done I as a producer, I work with all kinds of artists, and I worked with, you know, one singer who had become Crystal Bowersox is her name. She was, I produced a couple of, I produced one of her records.
American Idol, right? American
yes.
Idol? Right.
She became, you know, she was the finalist on season 10 or 11. I don't, until I started working with Crystal, I'd never seen an episode of American Idol. Mm-hmm. But I went back and watched some of her performances once we started working together. But, you know, again, she's an example of someone who became a household name overnight. She was one of the finalists. I was the last two on her season, but she didn't win. But she had just as much screen time as the young man who actually won.
Yeah.
And, you know, her, of course, when you first come off of a TV game show talent contest, something like that, the first record you make, they kind of have a lot of say in how it's going to happen. And the first record she made was this overproduced pop record, which really wasn't true to who she is, because she's actually a very rootsy singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. But that put her into the psyches of, you know, tens of millions of people, and she managed to survive that. And then has subsequently put out quite a number of records that are way truer to what she wants to do. Uh-huh. And she's not selling out stadiums, but she has a very vital career. So all I'm saying is that, you know, I think it's up to the artist to a large extent to take that equation, you know, of having had this gigantic blow up success, And then the like, as you said, sort of the plateau or the letdown that can happen after that, and figure out what to do with it and how to keep moving and how to parlay that into making their music as best they can on their own terms, if possible.
Well, you've been somebody who has made music for a long time on your own terms.
Absolutely.
And your 10th album, Silver Moon, comes out in April. And I've had a chance to listen to it and fall in love with many of the songs on the record. So let's shift to John O'Manson now, because ultimately that's why you're here, not to give us a history of the New York music scene in the 80s and 90s.
Sure.
But we appreciate it. And I think it's important that, you know, people who don't know of you necessarily or do know of you understand the commitment that you've had to music and being true and sort of being the godfather in many ways to the scene that we talk about on this podcast. It is, unmistakably Jono. I mean, who else could this record be? It is Americana, gritty R&B, rock, some elements of pop. But it is a throwback, I think, in many ways to A Night at the Nightingale. Was that purposeful for the 10th record to sort of be all over the map and be many things to many people on this record?
Well, I would say, again, short answer, no. I mean, you know, for this record, because of the fact that I work as of the last, you know, a long stretch of my career, which is very multifaceted, I've spent a lot of my creative energy producing records for other artists, and which is very gratifying, and I'm grateful for that aspect of my career, but it can sort of eat into my own creative time. Mm-hmm. And for this record, I made a conscious decision to take a break and write. You know, and so I had sort of a scrap bin of song ideas that I had, and took a break. I actually went to England to stay at a friend of mine's house, my friend George Breakfast, who's a one of my longtime collaborators, and wrote a few things with him, and then just spent time away from distractions and wrote. And these are the songs that came out. And so I think that, you know, all these the different genres that you mentioned are things that just come out of me naturally. And I think you're right. It is an outgrowth of those early days of playing in a band like The Worms, where we learned a musical vocabulary that was quite varied, you know, and these are all musical loves of mine. And, you know, when you're an independent artist, as I have been for the vast majority of my career. I mean, I was signed to A&M for one record, and I've had several record deals with record companies who might have had some degree of say in who would produce my album or how it should be. But for the large extent, I've always kind of just made, I've had the freedom to make the music I want to make, because there's nobody breathing down my neck saying, we need another record like the last one, you know? And so, you know, these are just the songs that you know, and of course, when you write, at least for myself, I wrote quite a number of songs, and these the 13 that wound up on the record were the ones that rose to the top for me. And then, of course, you go into the studio and you start recording, you see, and also this record was recorded very live, in the sense that, you know, myself, the rhythm section, Jason Crosby, who played all the keyboards on the album, we all set up live and cut the basic tracks. You know, a big chunk of what's on the record all happened at the same time. And then, of course, different special guests came in to add things, which I think adds to that vibe of it being, like, as you said, sort of like A Night at Nightingale, because it has a live feeling to it, you know, and a lot of my favorite records, and probably yours too, that were recorded that way.
Yes. All the good ones. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and so, you know, it's just kind of what came to me naturally. And I think, and I hope that when people listen to the record, even though, as you said, it is a little bit all over the map stylistically, it does hold together as a body of work. Because I'd like to think that my sense of melody or my musical sensibility and my voice kind of does help tie it together. And so far, the people who've heard it seem to think so. So, well, let's hope that others do as well.
Yeah, and I think there's also, to a certain degree, an overarching theme to the record about self-reflection and dealing with life at an older age, right?
And sure. I mean, I'm about to turn 59, so I'm not old by any chance, no. But I'm not young anymore either, you know, mm-hmm. and especially after a lifetime of making music, and you know, you get to a point in your life where there's less future ahead of you than there is past behind you, statistically speaking.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm going to live to be 120, you know, and you know, and it's interesting, because when I wrote the songs, it wasn't until after I started recording the album and listening back to them that I realized how many of them reference the you know, the end of life and what potentially happens afterwards and the existence of the soul or lack thereof, or, you know, and there are songs that touch on my feelings about spirituality, but without being preachy about them at all.
Right.
But it's interesting that that stuff sort of, again, just sort of naturally crept in. It was not a conscious effort to create a body of work, like a concept album, if you will. It's not like that, you know, but you're right. I think if you're reflecting the times you live in, whether they be the times, you know, that we live in as a society or as human society, or our times as the times that we're living in as individuals, that stuff will happen naturally.
I'm glad that you mentioned, and we'll get back to some of the tunes on the record in just a bit, but I'm glad you mentioned Jason Crosby, because he is in many ways a similar person in terms of career and in terms of being out there and being on the East Coast and the West Coast and producing and writing and being talented as, dare I say the word fuck.
It's your show. You can say it.
Yeah. But it's interesting that you mentioned Jason, because I think in many ways he is a modern day John O'Manson. I mean, he is as eclectic as you are. He is as talented as you are. And he is sort of in as many pies as you are. Who else is in the band beside Jason?
Well,
not guests, just the core band for now.
Yeah, the core band, the majority of the songs, on all the songs, the bass player is Ronnie Johnson, who is a native of Austin, who for the last couple of years has been living here in Santa Fe. And he, for example, was the bass player with James McMurtry for 17 years. So if any of you out there are fans of McMurtry's songwriting and so forth, Ronnie was in that band and played on all those records. He also played with Ronnie Lane from the Faces, and he was one sort of like a, you know, one of like the in-demand bass players in Austin, who I saw play with all kinds of people before he moved to Santa Fe, where I live. And when he moved up here, I was really excited because he's my kind of bass player. Super melodic, but also super pockety, super, you know, he's one of those guys who can be as simple and melodic at the same time, you know, great bass player. So he's played bass on the entire record.
And an easy doppelganger for Les Claypool, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry. And Paul Piercy is again another Austin transplant who moved up here to Santa Fe, plays drums on the album except for three songs. It's another guy named Mark Clark, who I've been working with for on and off for going on 30 years. And Mark was the drummer in a band that I had called High Plains Drifter, when you're going back to our earlier conversation about the whole Blues Traveler connection, which started out as a sort of Blues Traveler related side project. And that band, I was the front guy of that band, and Mark Clarkus, who I just mentioned, was the drummer, and the bass player was Bob Sheehan from Blues Traveler. And the guitar seat was alternately shared by Chan Kinchler from Blues Traveler, or Eric Shankman from the Spin Doctors, and Popper sometimes played with us. So Mark is also connected, even though he's a New Mexico guy, is also connected to that scene. So he's on the record. And then Jason Crosby, who we've already mentioned, kind of fills out the core band. And then from there, John Graboff, who now also lives in Santa Fe, who played for, I knew John back in New York in the 80s, and he was in Ryan Adams and the Cardinals for many years, and toured with Phil Lesh and friends at times, and played with Neil Casals and a lot of people who are connected to the jam scene. And so he's living in Santa Fe now, and he's just an amazing multi-instrumentalist, pedal steel, mandolin. He's one of those guys you can tell him to come to the session and just bring everything, you know?
Yeah.
And so he played a large role on the album. And then from there were various special guests that I brought in for one song or another, because I felt that their particular talents could help those particular songs shine.
So let's talk about some of those guests because, well, we've talked about them quite a bit. Well, some of them quite a bit already. When you wrote Love Me Into Loving Again, did you know that Joan Osborne was going to duet with you on that song?
I hoped she would, at least, you know. I mean, when I wrote that song, I wrote it to be a duet. It was my concept. It was kind of, I was trying to think of like sort of a Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell sort of, you know, 60s soul Motown vibe duet. You know, I wrote it to be sung as a duet. And from the moment that I wrote it, I had the intention of pitching it to Joan to see if she wanted to sing it with me. And I waited till I'd recorded the track and had it sort of, you know, I waited till it was presentable, you know, and sent it to her, and she heard it and responded immediately saying yes, that she'd love to do it. And for her part, I actually went to New York because her schedule didn't allow her to come to do it at my studio. And we cut her vocals at Aaron Comis from the Spin Doctors studio in Brooklyn. Wow. So again, all in the family, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the answer is yes. From the beginning, very beginning, I had it in mind as a duet. And when I thought about who in my sort of circle of friends would be the perfect person, the ideal person, I thought of Joan. So,
well, you nailed it. I got to tell you, you nailed it. Speaking of Aaron Comis and the Spin Doctors, and I'm in Toronto, so I want to give a shout out to Toronto's own Eric Schenkman.
Yeah. Have you had Eric on your show?
I haven't had him on the show yet. I'd like to, and for sure that's something that, you know, perhaps this interview will propel us to do. Talk about Eric's contribution on the record, because it isn't, at least in the line, it isn't obvious to me, but I'm sure that, what song is he on? What specific song?
He is on a song which is called I'm a Pig.
Right.
And it's in the middle of the album. Again, this was accidental. I was just sort of putting the songs in order that they seem to flow best. And in the middle of the record, there are three songs in a row. One's called I Have a Heart.
I Believe.
The next one is called I Believe, and the third is called I'm a Pig, you know. So a little autobiographical, and all those things at times do apply to me. And I'm a Pig is sort of it's one of the more whimsical songs on the record. Yeah. And Eric was actually out here visiting with me, just hanging in Santa Fe for a few days. While I was in the midst of doing the record, and he's like, dude, I want to be on your record. And so I thought this song was still, I still didn't have anybody playing the lead guitar on this track. We just cut the basic track, and I played it for him. He's like, yeah, that's for me. So, so that's the song he played on.
Another guitar hero, I'm sure of yours and mine and the people listening, and somebody who I can say, I think, as a friend of the show, is Warren Haynes, who plays on the first single, Silver Moon. This goes back probably to those, not Nightingale years, but to the Wetlands years, right? And how did you first meet Warren, and how did you decide to include him on Silver Moon?
Yeah, well, you know, Warren and I go back to those days in the early mid-90s when he had moved to New York, and you know, the early days at the Horde Festival when Blues Traveler and the Allman Brothers were both headlining that festival, and he sort of became connected to our scene. And so we met during those days and found ourselves on stage numerous times together. And he actually played on my album that I made for A&M in 95, and you know, we've stayed, and I've gone out, my band's gone out as support for Government Mule, especially back in those days. We did it quite a number of times, and so he's an old friend, and we've stayed in touch. And when, again, it's one of those things, when I cut the song Silver Moon, I had in mind sort of an extended jam outro that would was going to have a slide guitar solo. And mm-hmm. again, who better to do it than mm-hmm. Warren Haynes? So I, similarly to the story with Joan, I cut the track and sent it to him to see if he would, as a matter of fact, I wrote to him, I sent him a text and said, hey, I've got this song I want you to play on. Can I send it to you to listen? And he, his response was, I'm sure I'm going to love it, you know, which is a mighty vote of confidence, you know, coming mm-hmm. from a guy like Warren. But he knows me and knows my sensibility. And he was sure that he knows me well enough to know that I wouldn't try to rope him into doing anything that was less than up to snuff. So, again, I sent him the track, and that's another one of the overdubs that didn't happen at my place because of his schedule. He's like the hardest working man in show business, you know? Right. So he found a day off down in Austin and went into a studio down there and cut his solos. And then again, going back to one of the early things we mentioned, due to the miracle of, modern technology, was just sent me the files over the internet, and I flew him into the session and did a little editing and mixing on my end, but I had to really do very little to what Warren played because every note he plays is right on. So that was a big thrill to get him to do that.
Some of the lesser known people, at least to me and probably to some of the people in the community, show up on the record as well. Paolo Bonfanti
yeah.
on Shooter, which is this tremendously ominous blues number.
Yeah, Shooter is a song that addresses the issue of school shootings in America, you know, and it is written as if addressing the perpetrator, you know, and much as the, when they, you know, if you recall last year when there were the shootings in New Zealand, which was the first time they had to deal with this thing that unfortunately we deal with all too often here in America, the Prime Minister of New Zealand came out and said, we will not speak the name of the perpetrator. We will not speak this person's name. We will speak the names of the victims, but not, you know, because that's one of the things that these people at times are seeking, is the notoriety. Anyway, so it addresses that as if in speaking directly to the perpetrator. And Paolo Bonfanti may not be a household name in America, but in Italy, he is probably the best known sort of blues rock guitar player.
Oh, wow.
And he and I go way back. It's another very long story, which I won't go into now, but I have a long career working in Italy, both as a performer and producer. I produce records for a lot of Italian rock bands and singer-songwriters. As a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to go back over there on Friday of this week to work on an album and play some gigs. And Paolo is a guy that I've known and collaborated. We actually made an album together. It's called Gamblers. And I think you can find it in the States on, you know, iTunes and Spotify and all that stuff. Hmm. That Paolo and I made sort of like a two, it's, I mean, it's got a great band on the record, but it's sort of, some of the songs are sung by him and some, and he sings in English. He's one of the few Italian rockers. Some, you know, sometimes you get guys who, you know, in every country in the world, there is a roots rock jam blues scene, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't always ring true when people try to sing it in a language and an idiom that's not their native tongue. But Paolo is one of the guys who can really pull it off. And he is a monster guitar player. So he's actually on two songs on the record, Shooter and then the last song of the album, which is called The Wrong Angel. So yeah, he's a dear friend and just a great, great player.
We mentioned, I think early on in this discussion, spirituality and sort of your sense of where you are. And Terry Allen and Eliza Gillickson join you on the Christian thing. It's a gospel tune, I think a folk gospel tune.
Yeah, you could call it that, yes.
I think so. Like, I think that's accurate.
Yeah, sure.
How did we come to Terry and Eliza?
Well, the song itself addresses the issue of, you know, what it means. I mean, first off, I didn't grow up in the Christian tradition, I'm Jewish, as I think, judging from your name, you probably are yourself, or at least born into of Jewish heritage.
Yes.
Although I never didn't grow up in a very observant household, and my own sense of my own spiritual compass is based on elements of a lot of things, and I've found my own way, is as many of us have. You know, some of us relate more to the religious tradition in which we might have been raised. But the song sort of addresses what it really means to be a Christian in a time when Christianity and the tenets of faith have been usurped to a great extent by people who would use them for their own selfish and sometimes very destructive means. Mm-hmm. And so the song basically expresses that regardless of what faith or lack thereof you profess, it's how you live your life on a day-to-day basis that really makes you a Christian in the true sense of what Jesus preached, if you really go back to what the words are, and preaching love and acceptance and compassion, not building gates to keep people out and stealing and all the things that happen sometimes in the name of Christianity. And so the reason I asked both Terry and Eliza are heroes of mine. Terry Allen is an amazing songwriter and artist and Renaissance man who actually just put out a new album at age 76, which is remarkable. It's called Just Like Moby Dick. And if you're interested, for those of you listening, to know more about Terry. But he also wrote songs that were covered by lots of people, like, for example, New Delhi Freight Train, which was popularized by Little Feat on Time Loves a Hero. Terry wrote that. You know, wow. and other songs that you'd know. And Eliza is someone who I got to know when I moved here to New Mexico, because she also has roots here in New Mexico. And she is a remarkable, remarkable singer-songwriter, and also extremely, she's an activist and extremely socially conscious. And I asked both of them to participate in that song because, I felt like, first off, a song like that sort of has what could be perceived as sort of a heavy message, I think is better received if it's not sung by just one voice. In other words, if it's just me singing it, people might think, oh, there's Jono, you know, speaking his mind, and that's all very well and good. But if all of a sudden there's these different voices, all very different, chiming in and joining one another and weaving together as they do in the song, it gives it the sense, whether my hope is that the listener, whether consciously or not, gets the sense that this is more than one person's viewpoint, that there are many people who feel this way, because I know for a fact that there are many people who feel this way. So that was kind of my reason for wanting to have more than just myself sing the song. And again, these two people, when I sent them each the song and they consented to do it, these were my first choices, you know, of people to join me. And they both immediately said yes. And so they both came into my studio here in Santa Fe and we cut their parts.
This record needs to be heard, not just by people listening on their iPhone or in their on their home hi-fi system. It needs to be heard live. Is the plan to take this record out on the road? I know that you have some dates in Italy, a lot of dates in Italy, which is awesome.
Yeah, I'm going over there for the next, you know, between now and the beginning of March, I'll be over in Europe. But yes, this spring, I'm organizing now to do some touring this spring. I don't want to speak out of school, but yes, if you check back on my website, which is strangely enough, johnomanson.com, in a month's time, there'll be some tour dates listed. Definitely going to do some East Coast and West Coast stuff. I'm working on some New Orleans dates and some dates down in Texas. And so, yes, absolutely. You know, my career as a touring musician has been sporadic because of all my other activities, you know, as a producer and studio owner and all those things. But I also very much believe in this project. So yes, I will be taking it on the road.
Thank you so much. I've for sure overextended the time allowed to me.
Well, hopefully I didn't talk too much. Sometimes, you know,
No.
You set me going and I tend to digress. So, but hopefully it was interesting enough.
It was very interesting and extremely informative, and I sincerely can't thank you enough. I know what you mean to the scene, and I appreciate the work, past work, and I certainly appreciate the current work, and you've turned my mind and ears onto some new things that I know that not only I will check out, but our listeners will check out as well. And Jono, I can't thank you enough.
And, it's really my pleasure.
Let's please keep in touch, especially when those tour dates come out, so that we can keep people involved and ensure that they come out to see you. So thank you for your time today.
No, I've been talking with Shankwin too about maybe coming up your way to do some gigs together. So I'll definitely let you know if that happens, so we can hang in person.
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it, Jono.
You got it.
I actually don't have much more to add. That was time well spent with an absolutely genre-busting and talented musician, producer, and studio owner. You can learn more about Jono by visiting jonomanson.com or by doing a simple Google search to see the depth of this man's career and influence. Silver Moon is out April 10th. Before we leave you, have a listen to I'm a Pig, featuring one of Jono's disciples, Eric Shankman, the guitar genius of the Spin Doctors.
Baby, you're a baby. I'm a pig.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.